The Neurodivergent Woman podcast acknowledges the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community.
We pay our respect to elders past, present and emerging and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. Hello, this is the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
Hi, I'm Monique Mitchelson and I'm a clinical psychologist.
And I'm Michelle Livock, and I'm a clinical neuropsychologist.
Michelle and I met at work and bonded over a shared love of feminism and yoga.
We both saw the need to provide a free resource to adult neurodivergent women, and so the Neurodivergent Woman podcast was born.
Michelle is neurotypical.
And Monique is neurodivergent.
And we bring our clinical expertise and lived experience to the topics we explore. This is a podcast where we centre and showcase neurodivergent women from all walks of life.
Covering autism to ADHD and everything in between, we aim to educate and inspire women who think differently. Today's guest on the podcast is ADHD psychologist Chelia Falke. Chelia works in private practice in Wellington, New Zealand. She works with predominantly neurodivergent clients across the lifespan, and she engages in advocacy work within the profession, including being on the education committee for the Australasian ADHD Professional Association, or ADPA. Chelia is also mum to two neurospicy children, a 10-year-old and 13-year-old, both ADHDers. And just to flag with our listeners, as today's episode is going to be about parenting, we can confirm that Chelia has consent from her children to share some of their personal information. Chelia, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We're so excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, I'm so happy we could get you on. You are our first guest from New Zealand, or Aotearoa. Is that how you say it? And I actually met Chelia last year at a really massive symposium with both the Australian Psychological Society and the New Zealand Psychological Society. They both threw a symposium on trauma and neurodivergence, which was absolutely amazing. And I saw Chelia present at the conference. And yeah, I just had to have her on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I have to admit, I was excited and surprised that you wanted me to come on board. I thought, wow, because I've been listening to your podcasts and I love them. I really do. They've been fantastic. And I've funny that you've asked me to come on for parenting today, because I've actually listened to your neurodivergent parenting twice.
Well, I mean, I think that that actually reflects some of the things that we would love to talk to you about today, which is that, you know, when we just for a little insight for our listeners, when we first had a little introductory call with Chelia, you said something that I think will resonate with so many of our listeners, which is you were like, oh, I was a great parent until I became a parent.
Yeah.
Which is so real.
Yeah, it's so true. I think, you know, I'm actually an accredited Triple P practitioner. So I did a lot of Triple P training very early on as I was training to be a psychologist. And I worked as a family worker, and I worked a lot with children early on. My siblings always send their children to me during school holidays all the time. I was like a segregate parent, and I thought, yeah, I can do this. And that's probably why I delayed having children for so long, because I knew how much work is involved with that. And so I thought, yeah, I can do this. I know everything you need to know about parenting. I'm going to be a great parent. And when I had my children, that quickly changed my mind about how much I thought I knew. And then I've come to this realization that I know nothing. And just as I'm getting used to a new developmental stage that they go through, suddenly the rules change on me again. And my daughter's now going through adolescence, and it's like the tsunami of hormones and just the brain change and everything happening with that. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. So I keep having to go back to all my colleagues to talk about their experiences, read everything I get my hands on with parenting.
So, Chilia, we ask this of every guest that comes on the podcast. What does neurodivergence mean to you?
For me personally, neurodivergence means anyone who is an ADHDer and or autistic plus or has a unique learning style such as dyslexia, dyspraxia, dysgraphia, etc. And it's really about how the person's brain profile is different from the majority, like the neurotypical. And when I talk about brain profile, I mean like how the neuro wiring of the brain is set out so that a person experiences, interprets, and interacts with their world and how they communicate with the world around them.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. That's a really kind of thorough, good definition. We're wondering then, when did you first realize you were neurodivergent and what was that like for you?
This is actually embarrassing for me because I realized quite late on that I am ADHD. And as you know, I'm a psychologist, so I studied psychology. I went through all the training for years. I did a PhD in psychology and the like. And ADHD runs in my family like brown hair. And so it wasn't until I was a few years in assessing trauma, so a lot of clients with trauma, and thanks to my lovely Dory brain, so like Dory from Finding Nemo, so he turns around, she forgets what's going on. That's me. And so I use the SCID 5 for my structured clinical interview when I'm assessing clients with trauma. So it helps me stay on task because I get very curious about people. And as soon as they say something interesting, I go off on a tangent. And so the SCID 5 is a wonderful tool to help keep me on track. Now, in the SCID 5, there's a section, an ADHD section, and it has all the criteria for ADHD from the DSM-5. So when I get to the ADHD part of the SCID 5 and listening to my clients in front of me, I would be following their answers. And often I'll be like, oh, actually, I'm higher than this client. Oh, what's going on here? Oh no, they'd be giving me these stories. And I was thinking about this more. And then, so I took it to supervision. So psychologists tend to see supervisors to help us because our field is so subjective. It's like an art form at times. And I was saying to my supervisor, oh, this keeps happening to me in my assessments. What's going on? I think I might have ADHD. And my supervisor's reaction was, you think? I was like, what? When were you going to tell me this? So that was my aha moment. Everyone else seemed to know this before I did.
That's so funny. And something that I think is so common, right? Like multiple elements of your story there. Firstly, you know, kind of finding out that about yourself through the process of identifying with, you know, what was maybe going on for your clients, or even identifying more so with some of these things than some of the people coming through. And we know, you know, another really common route to diagnosis or identification for adults can be through their kids, right? Yes. And through a similar process of like, oh my God, I do that.
Yes.
And I loved your comment there about it runs in your family like brown hair. Yes. I'm going to file that away in my little filing cabinet. But, you know, the other thing there too around other people kind of realizing that more about yourself than you did. And I think that really speaks to a kind of foundational psychological concept, right? Which is like, we internally, because we experience ourselves as much more complex than other people observe us to be, right? Other people are only observing the outward behavior, the manifestations, but we experience such a complex internal world. Every human does. That often it can be harder for us ourselves to identify patterns in our behaviors that are actually much more evident to people just looking in from the outside.
Yes, yes. And our internal world is our normal. And so I think I grew up, ADHD was our normal. And my children's behavior, even when they got diagnosed, I could see it in them. But I feel embarrassed that I couldn't connect the dots and think about myself at the same time. But I was so busy focusing on what was going outside of me rather than inside of me.
It is so common, honestly. Like, I think particularly if it runs in your family and you grow up with parents who are neurodivergent and they're like brothers and sisters and their parents are neurodivergent, you know, that just is your normal. And sometimes people outside of that, like colleagues or your boss or your supervisor or friends, they might see the traits in a person but not want to bring it up, like because they don't want to A, be rude or like potentially offend the other person, which, you know, it shouldn't be offensive. But, you know, sometimes people can feel like, I think because of stigma, like, oh, what do you mean? There's nothing quote unquote wrong with me, or, you know, but I'm not like that stereotype of autism or ADHD. So how can I have that? Or like what you said, you know, B, they're like, oh, it's so obvious to me. I just thought that it was as obvious to you, when often that's not the case because you just grew up in your own neurodivergent bubble.
Yes. Yeah, it was our normal and it came with a double-edged sword. So there was a lot of pros and cons to being ADHD-er growing up.
I'd love you to tell us, you know, how does being neurodivergent and kind of finding that out, how does it affect the different areas of your life?
Well, it affects all areas of my life. It really is who I am as a person, with all its nuances and challenges and strengths. And I look back now and I still occasionally go through a process of grief because I feel that there are many times that I wish I had support and that scaffolding around me to understand who I was, and the challenges I faced in life weren't because I was stupid or broken. I recall going through my childhood and struggling at school, and I thought I was stupid. I grew up thinking I was stupid and not good enough. And I had to work really, really hard sometimes just to pass subjects. In high school, I remember just passing my last year enough to get into university. And I did music as my first career path. And for subjects I was interested in, I did really well. I did very well. But the subjects I wasn't so interested in, I would not always pass. And that was hard because I knew things, but as soon as exams came around, my mind would just go blank. And looking back now too, going to sleep, I thought people would just go to sleep through sheer exhaustion. I didn't know you get this nice warm fuzzies until I first took melatonin a few years ago. I was like, what the hell? And actually, that was my first experience with ADHD medication. When I first took my ADHD medication, for the first time in my life, my brain thought it was like this cool, calm sensation. And I could hold on to one thought and it would stay there. I was like, is this what everyone else feels like that are neurotypicals? Oh, and then I really did think of something very rude. So, yeah, that was a huge impact. It impacted university, of course. And I remember after I did a music career, I travelled around the world doing opera singing for a little bit. And then when I came back to New Zealand, I thought, oh, okay, need to get a real job.
Can I just, but like you just glazed, you travelled around the world doing opera singing? Can we get a little bit more info on that, please?
What do you want to know?
Like, what, how, when, where, why? Like, oh my God.
Yeah, give us the juice. Like, I feel like you have many talents.
Okay. I do perceive myself as a creative person, and I think that really informs how I work as a psychologist as well. My first love and passion was music, and I loved singing, and I was a bit of a show-off at school, and I'm of Italian descent, so singing did run in my family, and my dad fancied himself as a Pavarotti, and so I just fell into opera singing. I loved it. There's nothing more physical. It's physical. And I remember as I'd learn operas and I did stagecraft, I would memorize my lines when I moved. And so I was always going, oh, 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 and I'd just start memorizing it just as we're plotting out our scenes. And so I traveled around Europe and a bit around the USA with some opera companies. And then I decided I didn't want to spend my life in hotel rooms. It's quite lonely and isolating. So I decided to come back with what is now my ex-husband back to New Zealand and change careers. Yeah, but then I did a bit of work with the New Zealand Opera Company. I was resident artist for a year or two, can't remember. And it was just, it was a lot of fun. There's nothing like it. I decided to go back to study at university because I was looking through all the course options and I thought, wow, psychology really interests me. Because as I was studying my music qualification, I worked a lot with disabilities and I loved that work. And when I first started, I enrolled in a couple of psych papers. And I recall my very first paper and my very first assignment going back to study. And I actually called a friend of mine at the time and I was really distressed. I was upset. I was actually crying on the phone going, I don't think I can do this. I don't know how I can study again. I'm not clever. I'm stupid. How am I possibly going to finish this degree? My friend's advice at the time was just take each assignment as it comes. And that helped. But it was extremely frightening for me because of my past education experiences. And I didn't know I was an ADHDer at the time.
Yeah, and I think that's where knowing is so important. As human beings, we're meaning makers. We always want to find the story. And if you don't know why learning in a particular setting or with particular constraints or under particular conditions is hard for your brain, you know, the meaning that your brain supplies and that you're often explicitly told, right, in mainstream education systems is, oh, it's because you're not smart enough.
Yes. That's right. And I've got a few stories of that. Looking back, I had to use a huge amount of energy to study, a huge amount of energy to achieve what I noticed that my peers could do with ease. Huge amount of mental effort and energy to stay on task. My own children, I recall at different times a few years ago, my daughter once asked me when she was 7 and a half, and she was struggling with learning. And you need your working memory for learning at this age. You really do. And it's so hard for these kids, so hard to memorize. First 3 years of their life when they go through school, they need their memory. They need their working memory. And so these ADHD kids are already set up for failure because our education system is saying, oh, you have to memorize, otherwise you're not smart enough. And so my daughter,
without being able to move their bodies.
That's right. You have to sit still. And that is so hard for an ADHDer. You need to move to be able to learn. Your whole body, it's this experience your whole body needs to go through to help your system memorize what's going on using pictures, using stories, but not sitting there, sitting still, memorizing facts. There is nothing more painful and torturous than that. And so my daughter says, Mum, and she had a lot of tutoring at the time and she had years of speech assistance. She thought she was stupid. And she said, Mum, am I going to be okay? And I said to her, look, I know exactly how you feel. because all the way through school, I felt stupid. But I can tell you right now, you're from intelligent stock. I said, I worked really hard. I got a degree. Your dad's one of the brightest people I know. He worked really hard and he's really smart. And I got a PhD. And how many people can achieve a PhD? So it's, you have to work really hard, but I believe you can do it as well because you're part of us. So I have no doubt you'll do that. And sure enough, when she was 10, she wrote this amazing speech about her experiences of what it was for her to be autistic. And 2 years later, she actually spoke at a parliament breakfast presenting that speech. And you could hear a pin drop. And we had ministers coming up to her, thanking her, saying, now I understand what my child feels from hearing your story.
I just got shivers from hearing you say that. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. You know, Chilia, like what I really hear is a common theme for people who are ADHDers and a lot of them being like late diagnosed women is this recurrent theme of what you're telling us of, I feel like I'm stupid. I feel like I'm lazy. I can't do things, you know, and it's such an awful thing to grow up thinking about yourself. And then it persists into adulthood. And I just see so many ADHDers with low self-esteem and just this continual theme of self-doubt and imposter syndrome, really doubting themselves, their instincts, because, you know, of differences in their executive functioning and the environment around them, which has then set them up to fail, unfortunately.
Yes. And the other difficulties is the emotional dysregulation that comes from that. And it's one of my pet frustrations is how little emotional regulation is misunderstood in ADHD. It is the core of how we function. If you cannot regulate your emotions, you don't have a chance with your executive functioning, like being able to focus or attend to information or being able to hold back or being able to plan or motivate. Emotional regulation is everything. And I think that's one of my number one hardest strategies to get right.
It is challenging too and frustrating because, you know, emotional regulation is not really specifically listed in the DSM criteria for ADHD. Because again, like a lot of the criteria, both for autism and for ADHD, is mainly focused on like behavior. And when we look at the hyperactivity and impulsivity criteria, it's very much, about fidgeting and moving and being loud, but emotions aren't mentioned. However, it's one of the key things that we see in girls and women who are ADHDers, you know, and it's still a form of impulsivity. And we call it emotional lability, which is basically, you know, having those fluctuations in emotion, and emotional control is an executive function, exactly what you were saying. So I'm so glad that you brought that experience up.
Yes, ADHD, being an ADHDer impacts so much. And what I haven't mentioned is it also impacted on my relationships hugely. It did a lot of damage in my marriage. And when you are unaware that you're an ADHDer, there's a lot of behaviours you'll engage in along with emotional dysregulation that can be quite corrosive in a relationship, such as interrupting. It's incredibly invalidating for the other partner. Interrupting or just going off in tangents can be infuriating. The emotional dysregulation that can occur, feeling intensely about everything, like an emotional roller coaster for both parties. And so, yes, it can do some damage if you're undiagnosed because you aren't mindful of what those behaviors mean. The other component of ADHD, it impacts my work as well. So, in good and challenging ways. So, I need to make sure I take my medication so I can stay focused on the more mundane tasks like report writing. I get a lot of dopamine kick from working with my clients. I love my work. I love their stories. I think it's a real privilege to move along with their therapeutic journey. That's wonderful to see. But you put a report in front of me, I'd rather wax.
Oh my God, I don't think I've ever heard the tedium of report writing described so well.
When I first heard that neurotypicals got dopamine from doing important mundane tasks, I was angry. I was so angry. I was like, why can't I have dopamine doing these mundane tasks? That would be great.
I mean, I'll just clarify that as well. I don't think anyone necessarily gets dopamine from doing those tasks, but it's that neurotypicals have a dopamine cushioning, which allows them to do that task without feeling like you're being dragged across a bed of nails.
Is how I put without it. without feeling like you're physically dying.
Yes,
basically.
Exactly.
It does feel physically painful. And the some of the benefits of being an ADHDer, however, is I'm quick on my feet. I get so much done in a short period of time. I have ideas racing through my mind, and the passion I have and the curiosity helps me with my work. So I've got all these ideas. When a client gets stuck, I think of all these things outside the normal therapeutic box, and I find that so exciting.
Yeah, it's like with the relationship stuff that you were describing, I think this is another reason why diagnosis is so important, because when you're in a relationship, you know, whether it's friendship or a romantic relationship or family relationships, being able to put that framework to like your own behavior and the other person's behavior is really helpful, I think, in terms of just understanding that often, you know, behaviors and things that might be irritating or affect the relationship are not done deliberately or maliciously. It's just sort of like part of the person's neurodivergence. And then you can kind of, yeah, like have that reframing in your mind. You know, it's okay to still have boundaries and things like that and to express your needs. But, you know, I guess an example for me would be me being autistic. I always really like to be on time and be early to places, you know, because I get a bit anxious going somewhere that I don't know and all of that. My husband, which we've talked about on the podcast before, he's autistic and ADHD, and he's run about 2 hours late to everything his whole life. So he works on a different time zone, basically, to like neurotypical society. And
he lives outside of time.
He does. It's magic. It's like a magical like ability. I don't know. Yeah. But before we knew about his ADHD, because I knew he was autistic, but I didn't know about the ADHD until quite like late in the relationship. Whenever he was late to, you know, something that was important to me or important to us as a couple or like a medical appointment or something like that, you know, the interpretation that I would give it would be quite negative, like, oh, he doesn't care. You know, he doesn't care about me. He doesn't care that this is important. He doesn't care about the relationship. And that's actually not what the intention behind that behavior was. It wasn't that he didn't care. It was actually that it was an executive functioning difference. And no matter what he tried, he wasn't able to transition from living in that time zone to living in the neurotypical time zone. So yeah, I think just kind of that can be a good explanation around when we got his diagnosis of ADHD, I was able to accept that even with a lot of executive functioning support, that we will always be half an hour late to things. And, you know, I don't ascribe any negative or malicious intent to that behavior, if that makes sense.
Dr. Russell Barkley, I think he's a retired psychiatrist in the US, talks a bit about that and time blindness. I'm actually time blind. I think it's phenomenal how my partner could tell the time by the minute without looking at his watch. I'm like, how do you do that? I'm always checking my watch to see the passage of time. I don't know the difference between 5 minutes and half an hour. I could be sitting there doing a work task that I feel might be 10 minutes and an hour has passed. Drives me insane.
Hi, it's Monique here. I have some exciting news. I teamed up with a fellow neurodivergent clinical psychologist called Jennifer Kemp to write a book. It's called The Neurodivergent Skills Workbook for Autism and ADHD. Cultivate Self-Compassion, Live Authentically, and Be Your Own Advocate by New Harbinger Publishers. It's out on the 1st of July this year, so spread the word.
Brains can get very noisy. I tend to go through phases in what's most helpful in quieting that noise and recentering. And at the moment, I've been gravitating towards music and soundscapes, slowly making my way through the huge library on the Calm app. And I've been trying to get better at having a more peaceful morning routine. And I've definitely found that the morning playlists really help a lot with that, actually.
Yeah, I think most people think of meditation as the only way we can ground ourselves and quiet our brain, but sound and music are actually so helpful. What's really cool about the music and sound library on Calm is the variety. They've got playlists for times of the day and certain moods, soundscapes, and even alpha wave and bilateral stimulation tracks, which can be incredibly effective at helping you to emotionally regulate and getting your brain in a sleep-ready state.
For sure. My favorites at the moment are the Disney soundscapes. So they've got things like An Evening in Jasmine's Garden, Merida's Mystical Scottish Forest, as well as other ones that you'd expect, like Rolling Thunderstorms and the like.
The Calm app puts the tools that you need to feel better in your back pocket. If you go to calm.com/neuro, you'll get a special offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription. And new content is added every week.
For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/neuro.
Go to calm.com/neuro for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/neuro.
So thank you so much, Chilia, for sharing your experience of neurodivergence and how that's affected a lot of different areas of your life. One of the things that we really, I guess, want to get stuck into today is in particular how that's affected or, I guess, influenced your experience of parenting. So could you tell us what has been your experience as a neurodivergent parent, particularly parenting neurodivergent kids?
One of the most challenging things I find being a neurodivergent parent parenting neurodivergent children is keeping track of my own emotional regulation. So I juggle work and solo parenting, and that can be a challenge in itself because as I come home from work, my medication has completely left my system. And I've noticed that my brain's become a box of squirrels again, and I have no emotional resilience for anything. And so it's around dinner time, and that is almost like the witching hour, as parents know. And the witching hour is that time when everyone's hungry and grumpy and you're cooking dinner and you're trying to get all these tasks done. Now, being an ADHDer, you have to juggle whatever you're cooking, and cooking is not just one simple task. You have a variety of things you've got to figure out, make sure all the timing is right with your food and not burn it. Meanwhile, you've got a child hanging off of you, wanting something from you, or trying to sneak an iPad and have another 15 minutes, or you need to give them instructions to go and help lay the table. It's quite chaotic. And so keeping my cool or keeping calm when things can start escalating is a challenge. I found that the more I got to know my children and their own neurodivergence really helped me understand who they are and then be more attuned to their needs, especially with their sensory needs. One of the difficulties I found as a parent is when my children were young and before they were diagnosed, some of their behaviors were challenging. They were very, what you'd consider, hyperactive, very busy kids. I could never turn my back on them. In fact, often I couldn't go just to the park because I'd have two of them under five and they both run off in different directions and not look back. And so it was I always had to think, what am I going to do here? What am I going to do there? And the chronic and constant judgment from everyone else that thought they could parent your children better than you can, the constant comments, and even half a year ago, as my son, we were going through the airport and it was late and he was exhausted and we were in a queue for over an hour in customs and he was fidgeting and starting to get distressed, and a woman turned around and go, oh, well, you know, and she made a comment on his behaviour. And I said to her, he's doing his best. He's ADHD. And she said, oh, I'm sorry. So that happens all the time.
But it's so, I just find it so bizarre to me why anyone would feel like they have a right to comment on someone else's behavior. Like, it's just, that's so crazy to me.
It is. It's a challenge. And so and it's even harder when you're neurodivergent yourself, because you've got to keep track always of your own regulation system and in line with attachment and knowledge around attachment. Keeping an eye on my own regulation system helps my children stay calm. If I can stay calm, if they get dysregulated, I have to be aware of trying to stay calm, because we can feed off each other.
So I think you have hit on the money question for lots of neurodivergent parents parenting neurodivergent kids, which is that multiple and reciprocal emotional regulation that you're doing. You're kind of the emotional regulator for the household, in a sense.
Yes. And
if that's something you struggle with anyway, and then you add in all of these other little people, I also think that the amount, even for a neurotypical person, but obviously amplified if you're neurodivergent yourself as well, but the amount of mental and emotional energy it takes to regulate another human being, like, holy hell, that's a lot. So I'm going to ask you the million-dollar question now, which is, Chilia, how do you do that?
Do you want the honest answer or the psychologist answer?
The honest answer, please.
I'm a human first, parent second, psychologist last.
Oh, I love that.
And as a human being, I mess up just as much as anyone else. And there is usually a disconnect between knowledge and doing. And so, you know, just like anyone else, I have yelled at my kids. I recall a friend going, oh, I don't know how she manages this. One school holiday, she goes, oh, have you yelled at your kids? I'm like, what, you mean today or the week? Or what do you mean, this hour?
Oh, my goodness.
That's school holidays. I'm like, what planet are you on?
Yeah. And that's, I'm just going to pause there too, because I think that is so important for people to hear, that I think a lot of, I don't know what your experience has been, Chelia, with, you know, parents coming in your clinical practice as a psychologist, but often having this idea of like, well, the goal is to be perfect. The goal is to get to some mythical land where I can suddenly not be a human being and never yell at my kids or never have an emotional reaction, which is just so not realistic. And I think that it's so helpful to hear from you, who is a psychologist, who's also a parent, right? Expressing clearly like that's banana land. That's like,
oh,
yeah.
Oh, look, you're talking about rainbows and unicorns here.
Exactly.
And you don't want to be a unicorn. You want to be a goat with a horn. So you don't want to be a parent that's an A+, because that will do two things. One, it's impossible, and you're only setting yourself up for failure. You're not giving yourself enough compassion. And number two, what are you teaching your children? That you have to be perfect? You need to be a B or B- parent to teach your child resilience, and you role model humanity, when you make mistakes, how you repair, how to be honest and vulnerable, and that you won't have all the answers, but it's about relationship and giving them permission to make mistakes and growing from that. You know, there are times, many times as a parent, I've had to go into the bathroom to have a little cry, and that's okay, because this is the hardest job in the world. I'm a neurodivergent parent with two neurodivergent kids on my own, with so many more challenges than most other parents, working, not a lot of time for self-care, yes, it's going to be hard. If it wasn't hard, I wouldn't be working hard enough at it.
That's super helpful. And I'm wondering too, if you can share, what are some of the practical steps or things that you do when we're talking about that repair phase? Because, you know, I totally agree, and Monique and I've chatted about this before too, that in any relationship, it's not if there's a rupture, it's when it's there's when. A rupture. Yeah, exactly. But I think the thing that a lot of people can find challenging, because we're often not taught this in childhood. You know, a lot of the time we didn't have that model for how do you actually go about making a repair. So I think it would be really helpful for you to talk through a little bit around, you know, your general process, or what are some of the things that you consider when you are making that relationship repair.
When my children were born, I always felt at a loss of what to do, especially because my education was based on behaviorism with Triple P and CBT and all these sort of behaviorist strategies. And there's a lot of books out there on behaviorism and parenting with rewards and consequences. Those don't tend to work with neurodivergent children. With ADHD, it's punishment enough. Consequences don't always work because, A, the kid can't remember what they did that was wrong. So you're just providing a torture response. And a lot of time the behavior occurs when they're dysregulated. And so it's more about their nervous system going into fight flight. There's always a reason why they're behaving in a certain way that their system perceives as a threat. And it could be something so simple as they're bored, or they don't know how, they're frustrated and they don't know how to express their frustration. Or they might perceive something unfair. So there's that impulse, there's a reaction. So again, it comes down to regulation issues. Or there is a sensory overload and they get into frustration or meltdown mode. Many, many of their behaviors is based on their neurodiversity rather than what someone would consider a bad behavior. For instance, with my son, if he is bored or frustrated with something, then he's all over the place and other people would watch him and think, oh, he's being naughty. But he can't regulate those emotions. And so when he hit 7, I noticed he was becoming more and more aggressive because he was going through a new developmental stage. Boys around 7 turn into chimps and they get this testosterone spurt. And it's quite hideous, really. But what I was thinking is, none of my parenting tools are working. What am I doing? This is out of control. And so one of my delightful colleagues sent me this podcast on the Nurtured Heart Approach, and it's based on attachment parenting. And there's a book called Relationship-Based Treatment of Children and Their Parents, An Integrative Guide to Neurobiology, Attachment, Regulation, and Discipline. Well, I started listening to these strategies with attachment-based parenting, and it was all about being curious about your child's behavior, validating their distress, meeting their needs, being the soother, being calm, helping soothe their system. And when you want to work through a problem that occurred with your behavior, doing that when they're calm, but coming from the standpoint of curiosity. Why was that like for you? What happened for you? Even if they gave their sibling a good wallop, instead of yelling at them, don't hit your sister, is helping calm that down, making the situation safe. And when their nervous system's calmed a bit, going, tell me what happened. What happened for you? What was going on? What did you feel like?
Yeah, it's such a good point. And I think too, it kind of gets back to this idea of, you know, we often talk about, or in pop culture, it's often talked about this idea, right, of building empathy in kids, which obviously is a good thing. Don't quote me as saying Michelle is against empathy in children. I'm not. But to do that, we actually need to feel seen first. And oftentimes when the example that you gave there is perfect, right? One kid, okay, you've hit your sister, right? You've done something that, okay, that's not okay. But just like any human being, we're often not ready to actually talk about, okay, what could we do differently? What was going on? You know, any of that problem solving stuff until we feel like we've had our you know, needs heard first, and we've been listened to. And I love that you use that word, curiosity, because I think that really is, you know, the linchpin of how we approach difficult behaviors, what we see as difficult behaviors. You know, neurodivergent kids in particular, you need to be coming at it from the standpoint of curiosity. Are you genuinely curious about what's going on for this individual? Or are you thinking, I already know what's going on, and this is the solution that I'm going to apply?
Yes. And I come across that a lot with parents in my practice. Again, I see a lot of children and adolescents and work with their parents as well. And we forget that we're looking at the situation from an adult brain, and the brain develops right through to 25. And these children, depending on their developmental stage, they don't see it the same way we do. And so many times as parents, we will look at this behavior and think that they are behaving in this way as we interpret it, but they are not that developed to do that. So it could be something so simple as it's impulse control, or they took my toy, so I'm going to retaliate. Whereas a parent might see it, they're doing it to really frustrate me, they're doing it on purpose, I've told them so many times, and they just want attention. That's not always the case. And curiosity will get you there. It'll get you down to the root of the real driver behind that behavior.
Also, I would add too there that attention, wanting attention is not a crime.
No.
Wanting attention is a fundamental, like we all want attention. Attention is just connection. And so even giving your children that language of, hey, you can just say, I want your attention. And then I know, right? Rather than, you know, engaging in, say, behaviors, which maybe are to get the attention of a parent. But I think that mindset shift of that's not a crime. Kids are allowed to want your attention. That's okay.
Yes, and it's one of the foundations of attachment is being attuned to what they need, being seen, being validated, play, fun, providing an environment where they can be curious and playful, and just finding joy in them being them. And that provides this wealth of confidence for your child of, I am important because my parents see me as this important thing. They're noticing me, so that means I'm important. That really helps their self-worth and self-esteem. Many people will look at how I interact with my son and will say, oh, you're turning him into a mummy's boy. But I just find joy in my children being them. I find joy in what he's doing. And even if it's something so mundane, raising neurodivergent children comes with so many challenges for your child and for yourself. And it's such a tough job. But on the flip side, the successes that they have is nothing else. It is amazing. And I remember a time when my son, when he was four, really struggled with getting into a swimming pool. It was terrible, and he would cry his little heart out every time he went to swimming lessons, didn't want to get in, didn't want to listen to the teacher. It went on like this for weeks. But I was absolutely firm with this, because being in New Zealand, surrounded by water, I wanted my children to be able to swim. I think that's really important. And so we persisted. But the first week he got into that pool with the swimming teacher and didn't cry, he won Swimmer of the Week. Out of the whole swim school of hundreds of kids, he was the kid that won Swimmer of the Week. So he had this big ribbon. Now, I took a photo of him outside the swimming school, and I couldn't have been prouder than if he won the Olympics. The feeling I got from that was incredible. And so their successes are really big.
Do you have any tips for parents on managing like the conflicting needs of your two neurodivergent children within the same household, and then also trying to manage your emotional regulation in the midst of just so much happening? Because this is something that, you know, I think a lot of parents would like to hear. Like some experiences and like any tips.
Having two neurodivergent children, they are very different from each other. And for myself too, managing my own nervous system and regulation is a challenge in itself. But every day can be a challenge around dinner time, cooking different variations of the same meal because people have different sensory needs can be a frustration, and just being aware that that just is what it is. Holidays are really challenging, trying to get them off gadgets that they're highly addicted to, managing the differences of different households. So different rules in different households, everything is challenging. So one child doesn't want to go to the movies while another child does want to go to the movies. I've ended up taking them both to the movies, and one child sits there on his iPad with headphones on watching his own thing. So you have to be creative. You've got to get rid of all the shoulds that many other families do. You've got to do what works for your children and meet their needs as they are to survive and help your children grow into the best 25-year-old they can be, is allowing them to meet them with their needs, not some cookie cutter just because that's what everybody else says you should do. And so you've got to ask yourself a couple of things when you're working with your children. Are you trying to make them do something that's going to be helpful and useful towards their growth and development? Or are you trying to do that because that's what you think you should be doing? And so when you're looking at their needs, for instance, my daughter comes home from school really exhausted from socializing and things. I let her go and do that. No homework, because that's just too much, too overwhelming. And so we will do homework in the mornings rather than after school. She might need a lot more sleeping in on the weekends, and that's okay. Whereas my son is bouncing off the walls. And so I might have to get Granny to look after one while I go and try and play mini golf for the other. And avoid the meltdown when he doesn't make the leaders board because he didn't get in the top 40. So it's always just trying to meet the needs of that person in front of you at the time and just get rid of this nonsense expectations. We've got so many expectations of ourselves and of our kids in life. But if you can just see your child in front of you, what is it that they really need? How will they feel that you notice them, you're meeting their needs, their specific needs, to help them grow and be confident in themselves? That's what you should be doing and managing, not some cookie cutter, oh, we need to go and all play in this game, we need to go out at this certain time, we need to all eat the same dinner. That would be nice, but is it really going to improve their world?
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, what would be the number one thing that you do in that moment where chaos is reigning at home?
The stay calm and carry on poster comes to mind. I think sometimes a top up on ADHD meds helps. And if I am not clever enough to do that, is just being okay with sometimes I just need to change with the situation and be okay that something might not work out. And sometimes it's okay to get takeaways in the middle of the week. Yeah, I just think being kind to yourself as a parent, and if you're okay, your kids will be okay. But make sure oxygen mask on yourself first before you address any distressing behaviors. Because if you go into a situation stressed yourself, you're not going to be able to stay calm when your children need assistance regulating. And you won't really be able to get down to the bottom of why they're distressed. And that's really important because a stressed out parent is not going to calm down a child.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing there is in those situations, often your kind of order of approach is firstly to identify, hang on, where am I at?
Yes.
What do I need in this moment to be regulated enough or calm enough or whatever, you know, the case might be. And then doing that, you know, what do I need to do? I'm going to do that. And then it's about addressing the situation or, you know, doing what you need to do with your kids.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Watch yourself first, then meet your children's needs.
So, Chilia, one thing that I'm wondering as well, as we know, you know, unfortunately, a lot of neurodivergent kids and individuals, but particularly kids, experience pretty significant challenges with their mental health. I'm wondering for you, based on your experience, what are some of the things that have been challenging in that kind of sphere for you and your family and your kids? And what has been, I guess, you know, your kind of path out of that or strategies or approaches or things that have worked well in that space for you?
Well, in my experience as a professional and as a parent is that I haven't come across one neurodivergent child or teenager that hasn't suffered from some form of trauma and some form of corrosion to their mental well-being, and that can be tied in with the school system, be it with friendships or being bullied or feeling this otherness and not getting these connections with a sense of belonging. And I'm a huge advocate of looking after your children's mental well-being first before you address academic needs. Because a child that's in distress, a child that is upset or being bullied or is in a form of anxiety or depression or feeling bad about themselves is not in a good enough state to learn. Their system is too busy on trying to survive and it needs a calm system to be able to learn in the school environment. Most importantly with our children, our neurodivergent children, is a sense of belonging. And if a child doesn't have the sense of belonging, the mental health system starts to deteriorate. And so a child might not even need to be being bullied, but if they feel they don't have any friends or connected at school or this sense of belonging was somewhere, then they're going to end up very distressed and their mental health will take a nosedive. My son, that happened to my son a year and a half ago, where he was really struggling with friendships and he had moved classes and none of his friends was in his class. And he is liked, but he found it quite difficult to engage and maintain and deepen his friendships. And there are some of his friends that were in different classes. And I noticed he started becoming more and more into himself and becoming more and more upset. This got to the stage where I was called up by the school principal because he had a really bad day one day over almost 2 years ago now, and he was only eight, and he took himself to the principal's office for a bit of regulation time and time out, and he wrote on a piece of paper that I hate my school and I hate my life and I wish I could die. And the principal called me up concerned by some of the words he used. But from that, I started thinking, oh, I got to do something here. And I noticed he didn't have connection and that sense of belonging. So I put together some play dates for him outside of school with a couple of his friends that I knew he did like that were also in his classroom. And from that, he built these relationships and they deepened and he started becoming more excited with going to school, where he was starting to cry every time I'd have to get him to school. And I also thought, oh, okay, I'll get you into ice hockey, because I was playing ice hockey socially and I loved it and I wanted him to get into that as well. And he started playing ice hockey and he got into these teams. And within 3 months, I kid you not, within 3 months, his whole mental health started to improve significantly. He became part of a little team of under 12-year-olds. He was the goalie. He felt purpose. He felt connection. And all the kids seemed genuinely pleased to see him. And I personally believe that ice hockey has saved him. And even now, he loves it. He has this sense of community, this sense of meaning, this sense of connection. And we got COVID a few months ago, and so I couldn't take him to one of his games. He was sobbing. He's going, but I'm letting my team down. And I said, no, darling, you'd let your team down if you turn up with COVID. And so that is huge. And I think we cannot underestimate the importance of connection for our children and that sense of belonging, because that is a protective mechanism for their nervous system if they don't feel good enough, or if they have ADHD and they don't feel like they're achieving as much as they should be in school. But mental health is more important than academic work. I have a story that gives a really good example of this. I have another colleague of mine who has a neurodivergent son, autistic son, and when he went through primary school from the ages of 5 to 10, he couldn't learn to read and write. He didn't learn to read and write, and school was very corrosive to his mental well-being. He was the scapegoat in his class, like perceived as the naughty child, and that he couldn't learn. Now, the school wasn't as supportive of my colleague's son, another psychologist. Now, we just because we're psychologists doesn't mean we're protected in the school system. And I know of other colleagues that have had aversive experiences for their children in schools. And this is one of those stories. And so my friend, she moved her son at 11 to a more neurodivergent, supportive school environment. Within 2 years, that youth learnt to read and write to the level of a 15-year-old. So it's really important to be aware of when you are trying to assist your child with their schooling, mental health is key. Because a child's well-being must be looked after first before academic needs. You can learn at any time, but you have to get your child through education mentally safely.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think for any human being, but in particular for neurodivergent people, because there are barriers, you know, in this regard, what we really need for psychological well-being is purpose, feeling like we have a purpose with our life, feeling like our life has meaning, and whatever we're doing has meaning, and then connection and belonging. And those three factors, if you have all of those three ingredients, then you have psychological well-being. And what we see is neurodivergent kids, you know, from the start, often not having those ingredients. So being excluded, not being able to have that sense of belonging and connection, then feeling like, well, what's the point? And losing that purpose and meaning, and then disengaging from, you know, school and things like that.
Yes. And in addition is looking after our girls and some of our boys as well, because if you know one autistic person, you know one autistic person. And, you know, kudos to teachers. They have to manage 30 children and their needs in a classroom environment. And so they're not going to pay attention to that quiet child in the corner of the classroom who is being perceived as being a great student. It's a bit like watching the sea and there's a massive rip undercurrent going on underneath this calm water. And my daughter is very much like that. So she was very liked with friendships and perceived as, oh, there's nothing wrong with her. She's doing really well. She's a great student. She's quiet. But underneath, she was really struggling. She was struggling with her identity and connection again. And she'd come home exhausted after school each day because of that sensory overloading and with the ADHD of having to try and hold back all the impulse not to be perceived as saying the wrong thing, that constant holding it together and masking and camouflaging did a lot of damage to her nervous system. And so at home, as parents, we see this. It's like shaking up a can of Sprite or can of Coca-Cola. It's all fine at school. And they come home and they just erupt like Mount Vesuvius. And the teachers don't know what you're talking about. They're like, but she's fine. And like, no, she's not. No, she is not.
Yeah, such a common experience, right, for those kids who are internalizers. Monique, when you were saying those kind of three ingredients, like purpose and then connection and belonging and then meaning, one of the other things that can be really challenging for our neurodivergent kids when it comes to their mental well-being is that often what they want their purpose to be is different to what, you know, school and society is telling them that their purpose has to be. So it can feel like a lot of their innate kind of desires or drives are thwarted. And then the issue that I often see is, you know, then kind of the adults or grown-ups in their life thinking, oh, it's laziness, it's a lack of motivation, it's, you know, whatever. But of course, there's no motivation there because we know a neurodivergent nervous system is driven by interest and passion. And if those things are thwarted, then there's no capacity to do the things that other people are saying are important to that person, particularly if we've also got those other kind of ingredients of lack of connection and belonging, right? Like, why would you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yes. And so as a parent, you need to advocate for your child. And the way you do that is develop a relationship with the school. It's like anything, relationship with your child, relationship with your ex, relationship is key. And so when you are navigating schools, it's good to begin from a foundation of helping the school understand your child, understand their sensory needs, learning how to read their behavior. So there's no assumptions. This is my child. This is what these behaviors mean. This is their sensory needs. Please let's keep communication going. I love your feedback. I might not everything. I'm interested in your ideas. I'm going to share my ideas with you and keep in constant communication with their teacher. Get them on side. And when you open up these communication bridges, a teacher is then feeling more supported and less threatening if there's a concern to come to you and say, oh, this is happening. And if you're lucky, you'll get a teacher who also has curiosity and interest in what you've got to say. But it's a two-way street. So you'll say, I don't have all the answers. I'm very interested in what you've got to say about my child. And I know my child this way. I'd like to share that knowledge with you. And hopefully that sets up a good foundation at the beginning of the year. And explaining to the teacher, my child is an or ADHDer and this is how they learn them. Can you please just check in if you teach them something that they've understood you, or if they are feeling a bit overwhelmed, have you got something that they can do to let you know so they can go and take a brain break or something like that? So offering information as well as being open to receive information. I would also like to add, no homework. Because a neurodivergent child is already working twice as hard as any other neurotypical child, because not only are they learning in their education environment, but they're also being chronically bombarded by all this other information, like social information, learning explicitly, not innately, like internally. They have to learn this, how to deepen friendships. It takes a huge amount of energy to do that. So by the time they get home, they're exhausted. You're going to need to be able to tell the school this. You need to advocate for your child and say, no homework. They need to recover.
I really agree with that in terms of, you know, what I've observed and what we're now finding out now that, you know, neurodivergent children from previous generations have grown up and become adults and are talking about their experiences at school. And with that self-knowledge and diagnosis now, we know that neurodivergent people actually need more rest.
Yes.
And often need a lot more recovery time. And to be honest, often the 5 days a week at school does not work for neurodivergent brains and neurodivergent people, whether it's ADHDers, whether it's autistic people, whether it's some other flavor of neurodivergence. And we also know from some of the research around health conditions that, you know, both ADHD and autism, you know, especially if you're female, you actually are more likely to end up with something like chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia. And you don't want to go down that path of actually burning out before you even finish high school, which we do see in a lot of neurodivergent kids.
That's right. And as a parent, you need to be aware of their energy levels as well. Try not to overload them with too many hobbies and interests. You want to find interests that energize them, not deplete the energy levels. I notice with ice hockey, it energizes my son. And he loves the iPad. But if he's on that too long, it can actually use up a lot of the energy. That's not great for him because it doesn't provide the opportunity for play. But I do know from building up that relationship and connection, if I come up to him and say, let's play a board game, he goes, okay, shuts the iPad down and is really into that because that's a lot more fun. It's that doing. And usually I get a grunt at the moment from my daughter. But if she starts seeing us playing and having fun, she'll come and join us. Just always keep in check your assumptions and what you want your child to do that might not be in line with your child's energy levels or what they actually need at the time.
Often a lot of neurodivergent people need pacing, you know, pacing their energy levels with doing something and then having a rest. And actually, if you understand this as a parent, you can then start to model that and have that pattern at home. Then your children are going to learn that skill because, you know, I work with a lot of adults who have never learned how to pace their activity levels. They've never learned actually how to rest and to rest in a way that does work for them, particularly if they do have ADHD and the hyperactive ADHD. And that then leads to burned out adults who can't rest.
That's also an important message for parents as well, is to know your limits. Good self-care. If you are looking after your own energy needs, you're going to function better as a parent. So don't cut corners when it comes to self-compassion and self-care. Make sure you take those rests. Don't feel guilty about wanting to have a sleep in. Don't feel guilty about getting babysitters in to look after your children to get a break. Don't keep going past exhaustion as well. Start listening to your own system. And I'm not always good at that, and sometimes I have to learn the hard way to start listening to my own energy levels. The other point I want to make on with the school system is if your child is being bullied at school and you've got a good school relationship, yes, you can go in and put things in place with the school and they can be great. However, be mindful of your child's reputation that had been built up. So the adults, like the teachers and the principal, may be able to come on board and change the way they perceive a child, but their peers might not have. And so you may need to consider moving your child to a different school if things occur, just to give your child a new fresh start. Don't feel the shoulds with your child should always attend school. They should always do the full day. You need to be aware of your child's energy levels. Sometimes you might need to give them a mental health day to get that rest in. I do. I monitor my children's energy levels, and sometimes I have to say, yeah, okay, you can take a day off school. I can see that you're resting. But be prepared to also not make it a fun day home. So what I do is I say, you're going to have a restful day at home. No screens. I want you to do practical artwork. Here's a couple of maths exercises I want you to do. And so it's not fun, but it's also a rest, active, restful learning day. And sometimes your child might not want to go to athletics day or beach day because they get sensory overwhelm. Why would you want to put your child through that, or let alone their poor teachers? So take a day off, pull your child out of school on those sports days if that's not what they want to do. That's okay. Watch out for those shoulds.
We've covered a lot of ground today. It's been fantastic hearing you talk through being neurodivergent yourself and parenting neurodivergent children. Do you have any final words of wisdom for other neurodivergent parents who might resonate with your story?
The more you can understand your child's neurodivergence and understand what that experience is for your child, the more compassionate you'll be for yourself and for your child. One year, my daughter went through 10 pairs of shoes because she couldn't tolerate these shoes, and staying compassionate because for her, wearing different textures and fabrics is like being stabbed with needles or wearing rocks in your shoes. So understanding it is not something that they're just trying to do to you, but it's something they're trying to survive within their own nervous system. And it is a very different experience from what you might be faced with. So have compassion for your child. Have compassion for yourself. I will like to say that my journey of being a neurodivergent parent and solo parenting and being a professional, that it's been often really hard. And so I would call up my other colleagues and who are also psychologists with neurodivergent children. And I have one particular friend who compared her experiences of solo parenting neurodivergent children to the time of when she was in the Kosovo War. So she grew up in Kosovo and in a regime that was quite harsh, and she experienced being one of the freedom fighters and not knowing if her family was alive or not, and seeing the horrors of war and sleeping rough and not knowing when the next meal was going to come, and it was quite horrific and traumatizing. And then she came to New Zealand, met and married a New Zealander, and she had children, and her marriage dissolved as well. And the struggles that she had as a solo parent, being neurodivergent, parenting neurodivergent children, she told me, you know, Talia, solo parenting our kids is harder than what I had to experience in Kosovo. So every time I struggle and I think this is so hard, how am I going to keep going? I remember her story, and it is incredibly validating, because we sometimes just have to survive, because it can feel like you're in this war zone and you have to do what you can to survive with your children and get through unscathed.
Amazing. Thank you so much for that incredible story to end on and all your insights today. It's been super interesting and super valuable. And we were talking about as well outside of our recording, one of the things that we were hoping to chat about today, but unfortunately didn't get time to, is navigating, you know, co-parenting within a neurodivergent family. So, Chelia, we might actually have to get you back to talk about that. But for now, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you today.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, I have enjoyed talking about my experiences, and I love your show. I can't promise you that I'll listen to this particular show, because I don't like listening to the sound of my own voice, but I definitely love talking to you lovely people. Thank you.
Thank you so much. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support us further, you can do so by subscribing to our Patreon. To become part of our Patreon community, you can buy us a coffee for $5 per month or a wine for $10 per month.
All of our Patreon subscribers receive access to a backlog of exclusive content, to basic text transcripts from season 4 onwards, and to a monthly live Zoom hangout with us and our Patreon community. Our Zoom hangouts are a place to ask questions, chat about your experiences, and connect with other neurodivergent women.
Patreons shouting us to a monthly wine get all that, plus one exclusive content post per month. We really appreciate your support as we aim to make quality mental health information accessible to everyone.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurodivergent Woman podcast.
If you have a question or would like to contact us, you can do so through our Facebook and Instagram at the handle The Neurodivergent Woman Podcast or our website ndwomanpod.com. You can also email us directly at ndwomanpod@gmail.com. Bye for now.